When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. You know, the case of Rex Schuman, the alleged Gilgo serial killer, is, of course, back in the news because of the searches, or the search, whatever you want to call it, a search that lasted 6 days, which is pretty incredible because they've already been there. They were there 10 months ago, I believe, for 13 days. So what the hell were they looking for, you know? And we and all the other media people can just conjecture. We don't have proof as to what they were looking for. But they sure spent a lot of manpower, a lot of effort. They were there this time for 6 days. It would seem that there is so much evidence in this case that, you know, you would maybe expect, if there was a death penalty, which there isn't in New York, you might expect Rex Schuman and have his attorney might advise him to cop a plea, to plead guilty to murder in the first degree. But because there is no death penalty for the state to use as a bargaining chip, Robert Brown, the attorney we see on the screen here, is going to have to come up, or he's probably already has come up with a strategy to fight these charges. And tonight, myself and co-host, who just so happens to be a retired NYPD sergeant, a professor at Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, and an attorney, Michael Geary, are going to discuss that. What possible defense is the attorney for Rex Schuman going to come up with against seemingly this insurmountable amount of evidence that's going to be presented? What possible defense can he come up with? And we got a pretty damn good idea what that defense strategy is going to be. And it is predictable. It's absolutely predictable. And when you guys hear what our prediction is in regards to what the defense is going to be, you're going to say, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that makes sense because we know the standard of proof, which it's the job of the prosecutor to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not in fact committed, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So the reasonable person standard, all that stuff, I'm not going to recite a law manual right here because I'm not qualified to do so. I mean, could have Professor Geary do that. But we're predicting, and I think we're going to be right on target, but what the defense is going to be. And don't forget, 13 days on a search warrant the first time, and 6 days now, that's 19 days. The amount of evidence they must have in this case could probably fill 2 tractor trailers with all of that evidence, and not to mention all the digital evidence that they have. So folks, hang on to your seats, hang on to your hats, hang on to your wigs or your toupee or your special dog that stays by your side, because you're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone.
There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant, Michael
Biden. We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
You know, I'm going to get our co-host on right away tonight. I'm not going to waste any more time. Co-hosting tonight, retired NYPD Sergeant Mike Geary, professor at Albertus Magnus College and an attorney. Let's welcome to the show. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Billy. Good to see you. Good to see everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
You know, Mike, we have discussed off the air, and when we give our opinion tonight as to what the defense strategy is going to be, I don't think anyone's going to be surprised. I think everyone's going to be like, look, this is a very complicated case. It really is. And it goes back technically to 1996, you know, when one of the first bodies was recovered. So there's nothing simple about this. And then the bodies were recovered all over the place, and body parts in one place, one in Manaville, and in other parts in Gilgo Beach. So it makes it that much more difficult. So we're going to get into this. And Mike, what do you think? And of course, I put up on the screen, Proud American. I just saw that the John Bitroff did it defense. Proud American, that'll be brought up, but it's not just that. And you won't be surprised when we tell you what we feel, because he sort of showed his cards a little bit already. And that, of course, right there, and this is a better picture, is Rex Schumann and his attorney, Michael Brown. Michael Brown, apparently a hell of an attorney.
Yeah.
But he's got his work cut out for him. And Mike, you got the floor.
All right. You know, as I love being on the police side, I love being on the prosecutor side. So it's kind of like a little switch for me, but trying to look at it from a defense attorney's viewpoint, when Michael Brown gets in front of that jury, he's going to have to give the jury an alternative storyline. And the storyline, I think, and we've talked about this before, even Phil, we talked about this months ago, is that the Michael Brown is going to hang this all on James Burke, his own proclivities for prostitutes, his own incompetency as the commissioner, and having like a real bare bones investigation, like one part-time detective on this, you know, assigned for a couple of years, the refusal to work with the FBI. How would anybody conceivably refuse to work with the people who've got the most money, ability, manpower? So I think what he would do, if I was Michael Brown, I would hang it all on Mr. Burke and say he slow walked this. He underfunded it because he himself knows who did it. Maybe he himself is associated, but hang it all on him. Give them an alternative bad guy to Rex Schumann.
You know, Mike, one of the things, and you hit it on the head, that's what they're going to blame it on. They're going to blame it on this guy. And he made himself an easy target.
Yeah.
Apparently, there was a great deal of corruption out in the Suffolk County Police under Chief, who never was commissioner, Chief James Burke. He's a four-star chief, but he ran the Gilgo Beach investigation. He also apparently, you know, was appointed by someone named Ballone. He was appointed to that position to run the investigation and to be the four-star chief. But There were allegations that he was frequenting prostitutes and, in fact, had sex with a prostitute inside a radio car. So that makes this even better, because we know that the specter hanging over this case are escorts, and that Rich Ewerman, he had a proclivity for hiring escorts, and the women who were killed by him were escorts. And these have become known as the Gilgo Four: Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Bartolome, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello. Now, won't it be easy for Michael Brown to say, how do we know that Chief James Burke, who you see in this picture, that he wasn't part of this whole escort ring? And he may have even known Rex Schumann. Maybe he was in on it with him. Wow.
Yeah, Billy. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be easy for him because he doesn't have to make it up out of whole cloth. The best way to tell a lie and tell a convincing lie is you start out with a few granules of truth, and then you weave an entire web from that around it, and you surround this one piece of truth with a lot of lies. So he could start off by saying, you know, Chief Burke had liked the escorts himself. He knew them. He utilized their services. He was caught and he was arrested. So he's got already for beating a prisoner. So he's got an arrest record. He's a felon. He did time. He gets out. He's arrested for soliciting in a park, an undercover agent in a park for sex in 2022. So he's got these proclivities long now, and he had them years ago. The allegation maybe wasn't proven, but the allegation that he did have relations with a sex worker in a car. I think at one point he was living with a woman who may have been a prostitute too. I'm trying to remember. So Michael Brown could take a few actual facts that have been established and weave in a whole scenario that there was this sex ring going on in Suffolk County, and that Rex Schumann and maybe other people, like, for instance, people who may have been involved in the death of Shannon Gilbert, where, you know, they all kind of knew each other, they all shared the girls, they all talked to each other, you know, whatever it happens to be. He could take that little grain of truth and turn it into a huge, you know, boulder, and then just basically try to give that jury to say, look, Rex Schumann, he's not the nicest guy in the world, but there's a lot of evidence that is very inconclusive. James Burke is the guy, because nobody could be this incompetent at running an investigation. He did that deliberately to protect himself and his friends and everybody he knows in this little group. And therefore, that's why he never cooperated with anyone, New York State troopers. He never cooperated with the FBI. And so he did it purposefully to hide his own and his friends' guilty actions. That's what I would do if I was Michael Brown. I'm Michael Brown. I'm not mentioning the name Rex Schumann once at all during that trial. I'm going to mention James Burke a million times.
And Mike, let's not forget, in November 2016, Burke was sentenced to 46 months in federal prison for assault and obstruction of justice. And what it entailed was someone breaking into his car and supposedly stealing a tape that had some nefarious activity going on that tape involving Chief James Burke.
Right.
So how this is served on a silver platter to Michael Brown, to the attorney for Rex Schumann. That is going to be the defense. Serve it to me. Give it to me. Rex Schumann, of course, is absolutely innocent. And we'll get to that part a little later. But this is going to be the defense. And look, we know there's been a lot of fugazi stuff in this investigation. And you mentioned Burke not allowing the FBI, not utilizing the FBI in this case, and assigning one detective to it. A serial killer case? That is outrageous. That is so outrageous, it's almost laughable. In fact, years ago, when they first discovered these bodies, they had a police commissioner named Richard Dorner. He wanted no part of calling this a serial killer. They didn't even want to say what it was, because that put the spotlight on Gilgo, put the spotlight on Suffolk County, put the spotlight on the word, the two words, serial killer. No police jurisdiction wants to have a serial killer.
That's right. That's right. The dynamics suddenly change. It's not like a random assault, a kidnapping, maybe a burglary, you know, something randomly, sporadically through the calendar year. You've got a serial killer. Everybody wants a task force. All the newspapers, everybody wants you to form a task force and lead it. And they expect that there'll be no expense spared, no taxpayer money spared. They want this person found out, because if you can't find the serial killer, then nobody is safe. No one is safe. So therefore, there's a huge amount of pressure. And when you get the FBI, the state police, offering to help, and you say no, well, why? Why would you say no? And Michael Brown is going to say, yeah, he didn't want it because he knew where it would lead if they actually were competent. The FBI has some very competent investigators, and they got all the scientific information and the material and the ability. And just recently, Michael Brown was arguing, they were arguing over discovery. And Ray Tierney said, I've turned over everything that I have under the Brady rule, under my obligations, under New York state law. I've turned everything over to you. I can't turn over stuff that the FBI may be keeping. Michael Brown is going to take that and say, look, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the FBI probably investigated James Burke, and because he wouldn't cooperate with them. And so maybe there's a lot of information, maybe thousands of pages of information on what Michael Burke has done, and the FBI is withholding it. And Ray Tierney knows that. And so therefore, that's another little granule of truth that I can turn into a big sandcastle against the government, against, you know, the FBI, against Ray Tierney, that they know all this, and say, look, it's all start out with James Burke. He's the one. He is the most essential person in this case, not Rex Sherman. I'm not even going to mention his name. Again, not going to mention his name at all. It's going to be Burke, 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 Burke the entire time.
You're right, Mike. Katie Arney from the chat. It really goes into Burke's younger years. Apparently, he provided testimony as a teen. And I think it was that prosecutor that eventually pointed him to his job. Katie, you're right. And I believe it was in a murder case of a young man named John Pius. I think that was the kid's name. And three other juveniles, I think, killed the kid, like stuffing rocks down his throat. And Burke was a witness, apparently. And talk about the long term. Years later, the person who was the prosecutor on that case was in a position of power, and I guess appointed what we later became known as Chief Burke to a very powerful position. So, yeah, I mean, it's amazing in this case. Let me just go over some things. Long Island architect Rex Schumann has been charged, and this was on May 20th, as of May 20th, 24. This was written, with the deaths of four women known as the Gilgo Four, whose bodies were among several found on Gilgo Beach. Schumann's arrest came decades after the women disappeared and their bodies were found. Investigators used familial DNA to help lead them to Schumann. Searches of his home revealed a number of items taken as potential evidence. Schumann is being held in Suffolk County, New York jail pending his trial. This is the timeline. July 9th, 2007, Maureen Brainerd Barnes is last seen in a hotel in Manhattan. The 25-year-old had traveled from Norwich, Connecticut to see a client she had met on Craigslist. She was reporting missing several days later. The mother of two was a sex worker who advertised on Craigslist and Backpages, and usually went with a female friend to call for safety. The weekend she disappeared, the friend had left early and returned home ahead of Brainerd Barnes. Melissa Bartolome disappeared on July 12, 2009. She was last seen in the Bronx outside her apartment. Bartolome was 24 at the time, was headed for a $1,000 date the next night with a client in Long Island, New York. After she disappeared, Her sister received calls from a man who used Bartolome's phone and said he had killed her. Bartolome had moved to New York with dreams of becoming a hairdresser. She eventually began working as an exotic dancer and eventually as an escort, something her family speculated she did to make ends meet. May 10th, 2010. While Uman is not charged with Shannon Gilbert's death, it was her disappearance that would lead to the discovery of all the remains. Gilbert, 23, called 911 saying people were trying to kill her after leaving a client's house. She was also seen banging on doors, yelling for help. June 6, 2010, Megan Waterman, 22, was staying at a hotel in Hauppauge, New York, and was last seen walking toward a nearby convenience store. Police described Waterman as a victim of sex trafficking, and her family said the single mother had been taken to New York by her boyfriend. And then Amber Lynn Costello, September 2nd, 2010. Amber Lynn Costello was last seen by her roommate as she left for a date with the client who offered her $1,500 for a date. The client had called three or four times asking for a date with her. Costello had previously struggled with drug use before going to rehab. Her male housemate often went with her on out calls for safety. Now, that case, the last one with Amber Costello, of course, revealed a tremendous investigative lead that was never followed up till years and years later.
Right.
And that investigative lead was that her roommate saw Rex Uman, in fact, had a confrontation with him, and in fact, saw this car that you see in that picture, the Chevy Avalanche, the famous Chevy Avalanche that is sort of a weird type of car. And that's what Rex Uman pulled up to Amber Costello's house in. And remember, the first time he went there, they tried a ruse because they were going to rip him off. He paid, and then the roommate came out and pretended that he was her boyfriend, and they basically chased him out of the house. And then the next night, Uman called Amber Lynn Costello and said, "That was a dirty trick. Can I get another date? Because you have my money." And she agreed. And that's when she disappeared. And that was the lead, Mike, more than anything else, more than any physical evidence, more than anything else that was in the case folder for years that no one acted upon. And when they established the Gilgo Beach Task Force, I believe it was in February 2022, a month later, they discovered who owned that car. And this was sitting in the case folder for years. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to read the notes in the case folder. Mike?
Yeah, Billy, one more little grain of salt or grain of sand that proves the incompetency of the original investigation that was headed by Chief James Burke. So therefore, you know, while he was there, this is what I'm going to say from the defense attorney's point of view, is that while he was there, he put a damper on everything. So therefore, whatever he could hide, he hid. And perhaps he knew Rex Sherman. We don't know. But everything is going to be on James Burke's, you know, shoulders in this case. You got to do that if you are Michael Brown. Now, remember, Michael Brown doesn't need to convince 12 people of innocence. Only Ray Tierney, the district attorney, has to convince 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt as to Rex Uman's guilt. Michael Brown only has to convince one person that there is some reasonable belief that maybe James Burke is the guy, or at least Rex Uman may not be the guy. So therefore, Michael Brown has to convince one person, and it's just that there is some sort of reasonable doubt. So I think that's where Michael Brown is going. He knows Herman's not going to be acquitted like an OJ thing where he walks away. No. He knows that, but he's doing the best he can. He's a tough defense attorney, and Ray Tierney is going to have his hands full on this case because, A, this is there's a lot of information here for the jury to digest over the course of the trial. But also, Ray Tierney is hobbled by the fact of James Burke's existence as chief for those couple of years while this Gilgo Beach task force was initiated, where with one person. that's really very, very difficult for Ray Tierney. It's going to be a difficult case.
Miss Teddy H3, I guess I'm struggling with that defense strategy. How can Rex refute the evidence that ties directly to himself? If Chief Burke was involved or impeded the investigation, Jayhawks not charge him too. Well, Miss Teddy H, we're not saying this is going to work.
Right.
We're just saying this is going to be the defense strategy because there is overwhelming evidence against Rex Schuerman. But again, there's no eyewitnesses, right? No one saw him do this. No one saw him with one of the bodies. No, but we have electronic connections with the victims via the burner phones. And we also have DNA from the victims on items that were inside Rex Schuerman's house. We also have his wife's hair on one of the victims' bodies. You know, so yes, that type of evidence, but we've seen this type of evidence before, and we've seen jurors just dismiss it as if it was planted there or something. And let's not forget what you're going to hear right now. And this is going to put some doubt in people's minds too, the Shannon Gilbert case.
Somebody asked me.
I'm sorry?
There's somebody after me.
Where are you?
There's somebody after me.
What are you
going to
do?
What are you going to do to me? Please, stop.
Me, Mike. Brother,
you're hard to get. No, stop it, please.
That is the voice of Shannon Gilbert calling 911 on May 1st of 2010. She was calling from the gated community of Oak Beach on Long Island in New York. Shannon was a prostitute who visited a client in that neighborhood. That call for help did not save her. Shannon disappeared. The initial search of the area Shannon was calling from did not reveal what happened to Shannon or where she was. But it did uncover something even more shocking. A series of bodies and a potential serial killer. And as more bodies were discovered, the search intensified, and finally, 18 months later, Shannon's body was found. Tonight, we take a listen to the 911 call made by Shannon, which took 12 years to release, and we try to uncover.
That is unbelievable, right? So right. They have this 911 call in the cell, in the case folder. There's one detective assigned to this case, and they don't elicit help from the public by playing this 911 call over media. Why? Why? That secret bullshit in a case where you have no leads, that's inexcusable. Inexcusable. Use the media. Use the public to help you with this case. This was set in a case folder for 12 years.
Billy, it's either... it's inexcusable, but it's either because the investigator and the chief is incompetent, or they're incompetent, or they're trying to hide something. And I think that's where Brown's going to go with it. Remember, there is a lot of evidence. I was just looking through my list. There's a lot of evidence. It's all circumstantial evidence. Some of it's strong circumstantial evidence, and some of it isn't. But it's not direct evidence. We don't have a video of him, like you say. We don't have an eyewitness that saw something. We don't have a confession or implication through some sort of statements that Schuerman may have said to investigators. So it's all circumstantial. Not that that's bad. I mean, circumstantial evidence is excellent, but it's equivocal. It's not unequivocal. You could look at circumstantial evidence in two different ways. And so therefore, Michael Brown is going to be able to attack all of the evidence. Maybe not some of it's going to be stronger than others, but he's going to be able to attack it, even while he also attacks Chief James Burke.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code POD to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code POD at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code POD.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
He's going to keep put every time he attacks pieces of evidence, he's going to attack Burke. Every time he attacks another piece of evidence, he's going to attack Burke. Burke's name will be throughout this trial. And remember, it's good evidence. It's strong evidence, but it's circumstantial. There's not a single, knockout punch, a single knockout punch that the district attorney, Ray Tierney, can deliver to just knock Heuermann's socks off. He can't do it. It's going to be a long slog through a lot of circumstantial evidence that people may understand and go along with the prosecution, or simply say, you know what, it's equivocal. I mean, I could come up with several different conclusions based on this evidence. So therefore, as a juror, I'm not so sure that I think it leads to guilt. It could lead to innocence, perhaps.
Jimmy McNutty, you know something, if you were paying attention, you would, which you're obviously not, because you wouldn't ask this stupid question. First time viewer, supporter of the blue, do you both really think Burke is involved, or are you just trying to gain Turtle Boy popularity, dragging an arrested police chief through the mud for YouTube dollars? Again, you weren't paying attention. The whole premise of this show is that we believe that this attorney right here, Michael Brown, is going to use that as a defense. No, I don't believe James Burke is involved, and either does Mike Geary. But don't just come into a show and toss shit at us when you haven't even been listening. Just really ridiculous. So I can't take that, you know? Yeah, he comes in late, and then he's going to, you know, don't get me started. this is going to be also what's going to draw, they're going to attempt to draw some doubt with this case. Mm-hmm. And this case really was the catalyst behind finding the Gilgo 4, because this got the interest going in law enforcement, who was giving very little effort to this case before Shannon Gilbert.
What happened to Shannon, how she died, and why this case has still not been solved. I'm Vinnie Politan. Thank you so much for joining us tonight here on Closing Arguments. You know, when you grab that cell phone and you dial those three numbers, 911, there is only one reason we do it. We are desperate. We need help. We know things are not right. We're in a situation where we cannot handle it by ourselves.
All right.
State police.
Yeah, there's somebody after me.
I'm sorry?
There's somebody after me.
Where are you?
There's somebody after me.
Okay, where are you?
There's somebody after me.
Where are you, ma'am?
I don't know.
Are you driving right now?
No, I'm inside the house.
I'm sorry?
I'm inside the house.
What house?
I don't know. Can you trace where I am?
I'm sorry?
Can you trace where I am?
No, I can't. What's your callback number you're calling from?
Huh?
What phone number are you calling from? What is up there? Please, are you in Suffolk County or Nassau County?
I'm in Long Island.
Where on Long Island are you?
Okay,
No, stop.
Where in Long Island are you? In Suffolk County? Nassau County?
Why? Why you call me by my name? Why?
County, you on the line?
Stop. Please. Stop it, please. Please stop. Please, can you shut the door?
No, time to go.
Please.
Go that way, please. Go tomorrow. Tomorrow, let's go. Come on, we're all going to touch. Come on, go outside. All of us, fuck. We're all going outside. Come on.
No, please.
Folks, just so you know, Michael Pack is her driver. He drove her there from New York City, and she went on an escort job to that guy's house, who's trying to get her out of his house. To speed to what actually happened here, she's found dead, laying in the marshes. I think over a year later. And they had this, of course, they had this 911 call in the case folder for 12 years, and he never released it, which to me is inexcusable. It's when you have an investigative lead that you let it out. The position of the Suffolk County police is that she drowned in the marsh. Now, attorney John Ray, who represents Shannon Gilbert's family, he hired Dr. Michael Bodden, the former chief medical examiner of the New York City office of the chief medical examiner, to do a examination, not a new autopsy, an examination of the evidence. And I believe he got to look at the hyoid bone, which is in the neck. And it is one way, there's one way that you can predict or make a diagnosis that someone was strangled if the hyoid bone is broken or fractured. And Dr. Bodden examined it, and in his report said that he found that the hyoid bone was fractured, and therefore he's ruling this case a homicide. However, he agreed with all the findings of the Suffolk County medical examiner, the pathologist, on all of his findings, except he found that he thought that the hyoid bone was fractured. Therefore, he was saying this case is a homicide. Mike.
Yeah, Billy. And the sad thing about it is she was found over a year later. So there was not much left at the scene where they found her body. There's, you know, animals out there. It's marshy. It's the wilderness. And there's a lot of decay. You could either think that Ms. Gilbert was killed somewhere outside that house because the gentleman was actually trying to get her out of the house and therefore decided to walk and go really deep into the marsh and drop her body, or it's possible that someone chased her there, actually found her, tackled her, and strangled her there and then left, or that maybe she did wander through into that marsh. It's pretty far, and that she may have lost her way because it's that the reeds are very tall. You at night you lose direction because you don't have the sun out, and therefore she may have lost her way, and she may have just simply maybe felt exhausted, tired. Maybe she fell down on the ground. Maybe there was some hypothermia setting in. Maybe what she took depressed her central nervous system. But there's a number of scenarios, and nothing leads conclusively to homicide. Unfortunately, maybe if they'd found her body 8 months, 9 months earlier, it'd be a different story, but they didn't. So we have to go legally, because remember, you got to present this in court. It's not what you think may have happened. It's what you can present in court to a jury and convince them beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, this case is considered, I think undetermined, I think is how he ends up classifying it. And that said, we don't know if this is connected. People think it's connected. We've talked over a million times between you, me, and Phil, and we don't think that if Rex Heurman is guilty of killing these other four girls, we don't think this fits the pattern whatsoever. And this is a random outlier, this thing that is interjected into this case for some reason, because of irony, because in looking for her, they end up finding the other four bodies. But we don't think this really is a Rex Heurman case or anything.
You know, Mike, I want to just say that, look, I'm not going to argue this whole case. This whole case, right, with Shannon Gilbert, very complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of evidence that points one way or the other. The Suffolk County Police ruled it was an accidental death. Many people do not believe that. Johnny Ray does not believe that. The attorney for the Gilbert family, obviously Michael Bodden, ruled that it was homicidal asphyxiation, or he just said it was his autopsy follow-up investigation was very incomplete. For a former medical examiner, I thought the work was very schlocky and not, look, we had John Ray on our show and it got a little bombastic about 6 months or a year ago. And we were talking about this case, but I think one thing we can pretty much agree with is Rex Heurman did not commit this. If this case was a murder, Shannon Gilbert, Rex Heurman was not the perpetrator. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People can change. If serial killers can change their MO, it may mature. It may change over the years. It's not always going to be exactly the same. But we think that he killed all four of these girls because all four of these girls were found within probably a half mile of each other, along a stretch of beach near, I think, Southern State Parkway, where it's kind of wild out there and there's dunes and a lot of overgrowth. So they were all found there. They were found along that one parkway. They were found buried under the sand and dirt, and they were all wrapped in, there was some duct tape involved, and there was also some...
There was a burlap.
Burlap.
Eggs, yes.
The camouflage burlap. So that looks like an MO that's consistent with all four. So that's why they got now they have him. He was originally arrested and indicted for three, but now he's been indicted and arrested for the fourth one. So therefore, that looks like, if it is him, that it was something that someone would plan out and took their time doing. This the case with Shannon Gilbert, it looks like a real cluster freak, because you have this sex worker going to a guy's house. There's an argument. I don't know what happened. She seems like she's being followed. She's in the house. She wants to leave. She doesn't want to leave. The guy doesn't want her to stay in the house. He actually says, I'm going to go upstairs. And he tells Michael Pack, you take her outside, that sort of thing. It's a real cluster freak. And it doesn't sound anything at all remotely like these other cases that Rex Heurman is being charged with.
Not at all. Whit H from the chat. She was most likely in a situation where she saw what was coming, made an excuse to get to another room with a phone and called the cops. Not her driver. It was that serious to her. Whit H, look, we don't. look, she was in distress. Shannon Gilbert was absolutely in distress. Why and how? We don't know all of the answers to that. Heather, there was a hypothermia theory as she was found at least partially disrobed. I don't know what to think about that, especially after the hired finding. You know, Heather, this whole case would need really some very smart people, investigators as well as medical pathologists, to go over to reinvestigate this. And I think that the Suffolk County Police, but who no one at this point trusts because of, again, our whole dissertation on the show, James Burke. So no one trusts them or their findings. So that is one of the things that I believe, you know, is going to be brought up in this case as a defense, which is our entire dissertation for the whole night here. Elena Gonzalez, she was saying over and over she didn't want to leave. Poor young lady.
Yeah.
She was afraid of something. But it seemed like she wanted to stay in the house. She did not want to leave the house. Whit H., I don't think Rex acted alone. I think there was a group of sickos and he knew the dumping ground. You know, Whit H., that's a possibility. And you know something? One of the things, though, in a case like this that went on so long, and I believe there's a total of 12 bodies in this case, going back to 1996, people never can keep their mouths shut, you know? So wouldn't have someone talked? And I'm not saying that's for sure, but Rex Ewerman, you know, he got away with this. And if you believe, there's many people in the chat, I'm not going to take anything for granted, that believe that Rex Ewerman is innocent. So the search warrants that they did this week for 6 days in his house, are they going to connect the dots to any of the other victims that you see on the screen right now in this, the search warrant in Rex Ewerman's house? Will it connect the dots to unsolved victims? I think that they have a pretty strong case against the Gilgo Four, charging Rex with the Gilgo Four, which of these young ladies on the screen, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Bartolome, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello. And, you know, I just want to make it clear, because someone in the chat who I jettisoned into cyberspace said some nonsense about us not valuing her life because she was a hooker. We never said that. That guy came in with an attitude, and I blocked him immediately. I'll never see him again, ever. I don't know where he is. He may be on the planet Mars now. I ejected him quickly and with extreme prejudice. So he's out of here. But I would never, ever suggest that. In fact, in my career in homicide and in my whole career in the NYPD, I think Mike Geary could say the same. We valued everyone's life equally. Even if you're someone who's a crack addict, someone's a prostitute, we gave them the same type of respect of a human being. So anyone that says that, again, I'm going to jettison them out of my chat. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. You like real crime, true crime? From a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, hit the like button, share us with your friends and your family. And if you want to contribute to us financially, we have a Patreon with 4 different levels. And we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, 5 different levels. Our channel membership has grown by like 60-something% in the last month or so, which is incredible. And I thank our mods and I thank all the people that have given away memberships to our chat, including Rock Chalk, who has our own podcast, who was just on the show last night, who bought 10 memberships and donated. Thank you, Rock Chalk. I really appreciate that. So again, that's my commercial for this show. But again, we're growing. And Suhelia, good to see you. He's too strong, diabolical, methodical, and intelligent. I think you worked alone. Personally, just an opinion. You know, there's so many different facets to this case that takes in all kinds of, you know, known things about serial killers, method modus operandi, signature, you know, whether they took trophies or not, souvenirs from the scene, all of these things. And many people think that a single serial killer can change his modus operandi. That's a possibility, but it's rare. It's rare. Criminals get used to behaving in a certain way and committing a crime in a certain way. And that's modus operandi, which of course is Latin. And believe me, I'm no Latin teacher or anything. Modus operandi simply means mode of operation or method of operation. And that's the way someone, like just Rex Schumann, tying up the bodies with burlap bags. And we, no one knows at this point where the actual location of the murders took place. No one knows that. Could it have happened inside Rex's house, which was maybe the reason for six more days of a search warrant? Could that be the reason? 13 days initially? Yeah, absolutely. Did they recover anything in these last 6 days that brought them any closer to more evidence that would link to any of these other victims you see on the screen? To Shannon Gilbert, you know? And many of these victims, the commonality was that they were pretty much all escorts. And that is where you begin when you're an investigator. So I want to play a little bit of Rodney Harrison, his interview with Newsday. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Here, I want to make sure that this is very clear regarding identifying the box in Massapequa Park and as well as over in Midtown Manhattan. But just putting that dedicated team together, putting that one investigator from the state police and putting them to the task force. And now she using her database helped us really get this case some good legs and be able to identify Rex Schumann and go forward with being able to place him under arrest.
Now, when you say the box, you're talking about the box that was made identifiable through cell phone data analysis.
Correct.
Let me ask you this. You said publicly you called Rex Schumann a demon.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rex Schumann is a demon that walks among us. A predator that ruined families.
At which point did you decide that that was the best characterization of him?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of people have, I'm going to say, challenged me for using that word. I'm going to tell everybody right now that I'm speaking on behalf of the family. Anybody that lost a loved one to this predator, I'm sure they feel the same way. And as I was writing out my talking points, and as well as I was working with my PIO, we felt that was the right word. This is somebody that ruined families. And I'm just blessed to be in a position to see him being held accountable. I will also share there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code POD to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code POD at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code POD.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We'll have six other bodies that we need to identify who the killer is. But as of now, it was just really great work by the men and women of the task force. I got to thank my Detective Lieutenant Kevin Beyer. I got to thank some of the individuals assigned from the District Attorney's Office. There was a retired lieutenant by the name of Rich Zacharies. And there's another retired lieutenant, Bill Buchanan. Both of those individuals were there on a daily basis, regarding having meetings and getting updates and providing information to our pit bull district attorney, Ray Tierney. So it was a nice team effort of everybody coming together. I said this before, eagles were left at the door and making sure we worked in harmony on the same sheet of music to identify Rex Heuermann.
Now, there's been some discussion about it. What went into the decision to go ahead and arrest him,
yeah.
Right? So guns? You didn't know all, but you knew he had some. Mm. And sex workers, that he was still approaching or dealing with sex workers. Mm. His continuing contact with sex workers, were those women in trouble? Was there a plan to protect these women?
Yeah, it was a lot of different layers, by the way. I want to make sure that that's very clear. Between internet searches, between his lifestyle and other activities, him also having, at the time, we believed 97 firearms. There was a concern regarding, is he going to attack again? And as well as, is the information going to leak out? Is this case, knowing that we were onto him, is it going to get back to Rex Heuermann? We weren't sure how long we could keep it tight. So with all these different layers there, working with Ray Tierney, working with Steve Udis, working with Mike Broderick from the FBI, we all came to a determination that today's the day to bring this man down.
They pulled the trigger earlier on arresting him because they were afraid he was still seeing escorts.
Right.
And they were afraid that he was going to kill again. So that's why the decision was made to bring him in. And they had all of the warrants from his computer searches that if you have this, and I always keep it with me, this 32-page bail application, which if you read the computer searches that Rex Heuermann was making, they're extremely disturbing. And it shows a sick, sick individual. Mike, I just want to shout out to one other person and you can comment with that. Jane C., thank you so much for the $9.99 super sticker. Very, very much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Billy, the searches are very sick. We can't even really discuss any of them. We can't even name them. But if it has to do with a name of one of the victims, I would... As a prosecutor, I'd want to see that. But from a defense attorney's point of view, and I'm trying to look through the lens of Michael Brown, what can Michael Brown say about those searches? Okay, they're tawdry, they're sick, but he's not looking for any information on the girls, A. And B, if this is illegal, if there is some sort of federal statute involved in some sort of transmission of porn or downloading porn or whatever on the internet, he should be in federal court, not in state court. And this shouldn't be tied to any sort of homicide trial. So I'm just thinking, how would the defense attorney point this out? But from a police officer's detective's perspective, the idea that he's doing these really horrific searches means that his proclivities, his urges to do some terrible things to young ladies are not satisfied, that he probably can and will in the future. If he gets the opportunity, he may continue when he feels really safe. I think one of the people in the chat said he probably, no, but he didn't, he worked alone. Yeah, I agree. If he is the guy, I think he worked alone. I don't think he's a joiner. I don't think he would talk about this to other people. I think he's smart enough to handle this by himself. Remember, if you know something, it's a secret. If someone else knows about it, it's no longer a secret. It's just a story that hasn't been told yet. So therefore, yeah, those are terrible searches. But from a defense attorney's point of view, I would say they do not have anything to do with the victims. And the other searches that he did involving the task force, like progress on the task force, as a defense attorney, I'm going to say that's just a curious person. How many other millions of people on Nassau County and Suffolk County, there's like over 2 million people living on Long Island. How many of them perhaps did a search about, oh my goodness, how's the task force doing? I hope they caught somebody now. So it's circumstantial. Everything is circumstantial, but it is really distasteful. It's terrible, but we're not putting Rex Heuermann on trial for his morals and his personal habits, or his personal proclivities. What we're putting him on trial for is murder.
Absolutely. Gail McPhail, could it be possible that Rex and Ace's son committed the murders and his parents covered up for him? Just a theory. I enjoy listening to your information. Thanks for your informative videos. Gail, no, that's impossible, because Rex Heuermann had what's called burner phones, and his calls were going into the phones of the escort workers, and they have the pinging locations where those calls were made from. So they could say, oh, Rex Heuermann was at that location at that time, whereas you can't say that about his son. Good point. So that sort of dismisses that theory, but not a That's bad theory. Theory. And the theory. Other thing is, you know, serial killers usually are loners, and they act impulsively, and they act on their own. They're not, as Mike said, they're not sharing information. The thrill of this to them also is partly, if you notice the whole escort part of it, it has a psychosexual dimension with their brains too. And, you know, there's so many things that and when you listen to really, I'm not a serial killer expert by no means. If you listen to someone like Jim Clemente, former FBI agent who used to write for Criminal Minds, that guy is unbelievable what he knows about serial killers and what some of these psychologists know about these serial killers from the mental health perspective. It's just incredible. I want to play this short video about Amber Costello.
Okay.
Amber Lynn Costello called Clearwater home for no more than a few years, according to friends. But in that short period of time, Amber left a huge impact on Marissa Rosenthal.
She was really there for me when my grandfather passed away, so she was a superhero to me for that.
That was in 2008. Marissa and Amber were close friends, but Amber struggled with addiction, and Marissa recalls Amber's last-minute decision to not go to rehab.
It's just heartbreaking because I always question, well, what if she had gotten the help that she needed?
Not long after that, Amber moved to Long Island, New York. In December 2010, her body was found near Gilgo Beach as police searched for another missing woman. Detectives soon discovered the bodies of four women within a quarter mile of one another, dubbing them the Gilgo Four. By the end of 2011, the number of victims was up to 11, many of them sex workers, including Amber. Police launched a search for a serial killer.
It's just tragic and horrible and just horrifying.
But then news came Friday that after 13 long years, an arrest had been made. Rex Heuermann, a 59-year-old architect from Long Island, was charged with killing Amber and two other women. Investigators believe he may be responsible for other murders.
We executed over 300 subpoenas. We were able to identify seven separate burner phones that he used.
The arrest brought back a flood of emotions to Marissa.
To just go back to my friendship with Amber in that time of life, and just thinking through everything that happened is incredibly sad.
But if Herman is guilty, there's also some relief.
It does bring a certain amount of peace, you know, to my heart to think of you know, his actions will be prevented for doing this to anybody else.
Perhaps more than anything else, Marissa just wishes she could see her friend one last time.
Oh, man. Yeah, I miss her a lot. She was a good friend.
Yeah, all those years later still has that heartbreak. Police say they landed on Herman as a suspect during a review of evidence, including a car red.
So, you know, one of the things that came out of the Amber Costello case, of course, and we spoke about it before, and it was, again, it's so frustrating because it's this car here, that Chevy Avalanche, that was named in the case folder in an interview with Amber Costello's roommate, who also saw Rex Schumann. And you know, look, the roommate was addicted, a drug addict. And, you know, people called him Amber Lynn's pimp or whatever he was. But so I don't know whether he wasn't taken seriously back then, because when he's interviewed today, he's perfectly lucid and gives this very accurate information about that car, the Chevy Avalanche, and about he's the one that came up with the term calling Rex Schumann an ogre.
Yes.
And described him as 6'6", 300 pounds. That is a pretty damn good description of someone. Not many people are 6'6" and 300 pounds. I don't see them walking around the street very often. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, Billy, Michael Brown, this is going to be a very difficult piece of information to hang on someone else because of the uniqueness of the description. I mean, after all, 6'6" is huge. I mean, outside the NFL, I mean, you don't see that sort of thing. So therefore, A, that's going to be difficult for Michael Brown to poo-poo. B, the description was fresh. It wasn't like, oh, I remember him now, I couldn't remember him in the past. No. The guy who described him very quickly within, like, say, 48 hours to the police when they took the missing persons report. He described the car, very, very low popularity car. It wasn't that hybrid or whatever you call it, Chevy Avalanche. You know, that really wasn't a very popular model. So there's two really interesting things. And then when they go do the search, they find the location, they find Herman, they do a search of the house. And what do you see? It pops up right there. But as much as it hurts Michael Brown, Michael Brown can say it's Jim Burke's fault. It's all Chief Burke's fault. But that is going to be a really difficult piece of evidence for Michael Brown to get around, because that really, it's circumstantial, but it's very strong circumstantial evidence that he was involved in at least one of the murders. And if you think he's involved in one of the murders as a juror, it makes it easier to look at the other circumstantial evidence in a more powerful light. And therefore, if the jury can be convinced that he did her death, he killed her, then it makes it much easier for them to say, okay, well, if he killed her, he must have killed her. And her, and her, and her, you know, just keep going down the line. Very difficult piece of evidence for Michael Brown to combat, but that's really strong. Just look at that innocent little picture of that car sitting in front of that house. Amazing.
You know, the amazing thing also is that when they discovered this car, when they searched, the task force was started in January 2022. Right. In February, they discovered who owned this car. And it was 6'6", 300 pound ogre, as was described in the report that was done years earlier. Yeah. And when they looked further back, they found the car on Google Earth. They pulled up a Google Earth picture of the house, and there was the damn car. Not the license plate. Science, Mike. None of this is rocket science.
No.
But it shows the detectives were not doing their job, because they were not directed to do their job. An investigator from the New York State Police actually pointed out, for Rodney Harrison, she's a female investigator, a month after she got there, she identified the car and the owner. I mean, if she could do that in 1 month, why couldn't it be done in 12 years?
Billy, that leads as from Michael Brown's perspective, it leads back to James Burke. And therefore, because you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure this one out. You've got the Google Earth photo. You got the license plate. You got a picture of the house. All you'd have to do is find out who lives there and then take their driver's license, take a picture of their driver's license. And you might see something like, you know, hair color, eye color, height, whatever it happens to be. And you look at this picture going, oh my goodness, look where this house is located. Look at this person. We could go to the local train station, the Long Island Railroad station, because this person, maybe they commute in and out of New York City, that sort of thing. Put an undercover person watching the house from a block away. You know, there's so many things you could do. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. And this state trooper, she gets the job. She does this, and she does it very, very quickly. And it's like, boom, if this could have been acted on years earlier, we don't know. It may have saved some other person's life. But
if you know, and all of us deal with computers.
Right.
It was the simple way that it was run. Was it run as a passenger vehicle, or was it run as a truck, or was it run as an SUV? Apparently, however this female investigator from the state police ran it, boom, she came up with the green Chevy Avalanche and Rex Uhrman. And for 12 years, they couldn't find the owner of this car, who turns out to be the serial killer, and they couldn't find the car or where it came back to. But yet, folks, listen to this, and you, a lot of people following this case know that the cell site information pinged lots of times in Massapequa Park, where this 6'6", 300-pound ogre lived, and sometimes in Amityville, where there was a hotel where people would bring escorts to. And they had all of this information. Like you said, Mike, if the potential serial killer lived in Massapequa Park and they knew that he had a green Chevy Avalanche, why couldn't they have just canvassed the Long Island Railroad Station in Massapequa? And, you know, if you see a guy like that, don't jump him. Just see who he is. Get right. The license plate of his car. Do a background on him. Now, put him under surveillance. I mean, it sounds so simple now. Why didn't they do this? You know, but in 12 years, they couldn't solve this case. But in 2 months, they did. So that points, again, to the defense that's going to be raised by Michael Brown, who you see on the screen. These are all great reasons he's going to go with that defense, because I don't think he has much else to go with, because there's tons of evidence. Let me play this, Mike.
Has now been behind bars for 9 months following his 2023 arrest for the Gilgo Beach killings. Today, he appeared in court where his lawyers made new requests to the judge. CBS2's Jennifer McLogan has details.
Asa Ellerup, the estranged wife of Rex Uhrman, exchanged glances with the suspected serial killer during a Riverhead court appearance. The former Manhattan architect appeared handcuffed in a wrinkled suit.
He is not the guy. He said that over and over. He wants to get to trial.
But first, defense attorneys want all files from the FBI pertaining to other possible leads and suspects that may have been dismissed as irrelevant.
Our information and belief is the Suffolk County Police Department, especially with Chief Burke in charge, and the FBI were butting heads. And to some extent, I think Chief Burke was suppressing the investigation.
Former Suffolk Chief James Burke has since served time in prison for beating and cover-up, later arrested for public lewdness. His attorney says the serial killer defense is grasping at straws. Huerman's lawyers also want more from the DA on a former police officer suspect with the initials WH, a belt with those initials found on a victim.
7,000 pages with regard to persons of interest.
The DA says all their documentation is being disclosed, DNA, lab reports, background checks, including Huerman's 422 smart devices seized during raids allegedly used to contact and research sex workers.
Digital devices. So you're talking about phones, laptops, CDs.
Huerman's pleaded not guilty to the murders of four women whose nude bodies wrapped in burlap were found in shallow graves near Gilgo Beach in 2010. Inside the Riverhead Jail, Huerman now visits chapel and and invites prayer, according to the Suffolk County Sheriff.
Clerics or religious professionals come in to his housing area, and so it's more of a one-on-one in a more private location.
The judge wants all the discovery material, a voluminous amount, to be handed over to the defense by the end of July, before a future trial date can even be considered for the accused Gilgo Beach serial killer. On Long Island, Jennifer McLogan, CBS 2 News.
The remains of 11 people were found near Gilgo Beach between 1996 and 2011. Huerman has been linked to four victims.
So, Mike, there you go. I mean, so, again, predictable. Michael Brown, of course, he went right to James Burke. And that is going to be what this defense is all about. It's going to be all about James Burke. And I want to play one other thing. And we, as you know, Mike, we had John Ray on our show.
Oh, I remember.
And it got a little bombastic. I respect John Ray. I like John Ray. I think his heart is in the right place.
He's passionate. Yes.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with him, but this itself also can create a lot of doubt in the minds. And John Ray could wind up being a witness in this case.
Right.
So let me play a little bit of this press conference he did with Rodney Harrison.
We're here today because new information has been has arisen in this case from witnesses who were so far unknown. Those witnesses, of which there are four, have given us statements, two of whom have given us affidavits regarding this case, regarding Rex Huerman and Shannon Gilbert and Karen Vergata. Before I talk about them, first, I want you to be aware that here stands the commissioner, as you know, with me. And up until now, we have not made it known to the public that we have been working together on this case steadily since the time that I came to know Commissioner Harris a year ago, February. We, up until that point, the police department was very resistant to receiving any kind of evidence or information from my office, from what I was doing. That all changed significantly when Commissioner Harris stepped in and we began to collaborate. And we've collaborated ever since. That collaboration has had fruit. And that fruit, at least, are the witnesses I'm going to be talking about today, as well as other evidence and information which we have shared together and with the police department, and this, therefore with the task force. So it is true to say that our cooperation has given rise to more substantial, valuable evidence in the entire case of the Long Island serial killer. So with that in mind, I'm very pleased that Commissioner Harrison has seen fit to open his mind and to do what I'm suggesting has been done, contrary to all those who have come before him. And he's approaching this case in the right way. He's the right man for the job, and he's done his job well. As to the witnesses, as to the evidence, in no particular order of importance, because so much of it is important. I have stood as a beacon to, as a civilian beacon, to the people who are involved in this case to come and talk where they didn't want to approach the police out of fear, out of apprehension, out of a natural, some in some cases, a natural distaste for the police department because of the work these people were in. So they would then come to me and speak to me, and I would interview them, and we would then cooperate, I, them, and the police department. And so with that in mind, the first two witnesses I'm going to talk about are both of them are not Suffolk County residents. I should point out that we obtained from these two affidavits their names will go unmentioned. Their names are blotted out of the affidavits, but the affidavits will be available to you right after the press conference. As to the first one I'll talk about, this is a witness who has every reason to have no bias, no interest in the case whatsoever. She was not a sex worker, is not a sex worker, and instead, back in the 90s, in the 1990s, she was what is known then and now as a swinger. She would have a sex partner, and they would go to certain sex clubs in New York City where they would switch partners with other people of like kind. One of the most important places that they would go was called La Trapeze on West 27th Street in New York, right near Rex Heuermann's office. And this was a notorious place for swapping, for switching partners. Sometimes several hundred people at a time would be involved in this place in its heyday. Its heyday was in the late 90s, right at the time that Karen Brigata is involved in this case. In this situation, this particular woman was dating a police officer from New York City who was a narcotics, a detective, and they would go to these switchy clubs, these swapping clubs. At a certain time, at or about Valentine's Day of 1996, I believe, the couple went to La Trapeze, and I think it was on the wall at La Trapeze where an advertisement was placed to go to a house in Massapequa Park for partying, for switching, for swapping. She went with her boyfriend out to Long Island. But before they went, her boyfriend picked up a woman in New York, in the city, who had apparently just gotten out of jail. And she was disheveled and hungry. And she was a sex worker. We don't know the details yet of how he came to know her, but he knew her. And she came in the car with the two of them. They went to Massapequa Park. Before they got there, they stopped at a gas station, and the girl who was with them expressed some apprehension about where they were going and why. That was all wiped out when it was pointed out that he's a police detective, so don't worry, no problem. They ended up going to Rex Heuermann's house. In the house was the wife of Rex Heuermann, and Rex Heuermann and the other girl. The other girl who we believe to be Karen Brigata. This girl disappears downstairs at the house. Rex Heuermann disappears. And according to our witness and other witnesses I've talked to, when men are swingers with their partner, very often they switch sexually, they go back and forth between male and female. And so Heuermann leaves the main floor and disappears either into another bedroom or downstairs. It's not clear. And the witness talks to Rex's wife. She doesn't want to have sex like she had expected to occur because our client believes because our client is an African-American woman. And Heuermann didn't like that. Ellerup, rather, didn't like that. So there was no sex between them, as was originally planned. Instead, the sex is between Heuermann and the other man. At some point, the witness goes looking for her partner and is kind of upset that he doesn't emerge. He emerges. And finally, they leave, and kind of in a hurry. But when they leave, as they're leaving, the witness points out that she could see in the window, looking out, the girl that had come with them. And she says to her, her driver, her partner, what are we doing? Are we taking her? And the partner says, don't worry. They're just playing a game. She stays there. No problem. With that, the girl runs out of the house naked and is running in front of the garage. And now the witness says, hey, shouldn't we be taking her? Something's wrong here. And the driver tells her, nah, they're just playing a game. Leave it. And they leave. She never hears about the incident again. She distinctly remembers Uriman. She also had intercourse with Uriman that same day. And she kind of, you know, buries it. It forgets about it. Until on TV, she sees the picture of Karen Bogata. And she recognizes her and said, that's her. And she recognizes Rex Uriman.
I'm not going to play this whole thing, right. But just that creates another layer of doubt. And the fact that, I mean, I don't buy this whole story, but in Johnny Ray's story, John Ray, it implicates Asa Ellerup as being involved in her husband, Rex Uriman's, well, let's call it a swingers, and almost like that he was saying that she was involved. And he tells two or three more stories in regards to this. I want to play the whole thing. It would take too long, but just the whole point of our dissertation tonight, which is, of course, what is the defense going to be? Well, I believe he's going to call John Ray as well as potentially former police commissioner Rodney Harrison in as witnesses. It at least muddies the water and creates some kind of doubt. But again, is any of this stuff enough to combat, you know, two tractor trailers full of evidence that they have against Rex Uriman? And I'm exaggerating, but a voluminous amount of evidence against Rex Uriman. Is the other stuff enough doubt to prevent Rex Uriman from getting convicted in this case?
Billy, it may, in a stretch, because remember, Michael Brown has to convince only one person that there is some reasonable doubt, and that's a very low standard. And so therefore, by calling, you know, this gentleman with the hat and the tie and Johnny Ray, that because Johnny Ray said he spoke to these people, two out of the four offered affidavits, sworn affidavits, the other two didn't. So Johnny Ray spoke directly to them. He could convey what they said if they can't be found. If they can be found, they will have to be dragged into court. But who knows if they can even be found. And if they say they are found and they're dragged into court, but what they don't remember, what he said they said, what he's telling the people that they remember, it hurts his credibility. I could see Michael Brown playing real hardball and saying, we're going to get Johnny Ray up here and we're going to get Chief Harrison, because Harrison, as Johnny Ray said, Harrison and he are working together on this case and they're exchanging evidence. And so therefore, when you use that word evidence, obviously they're not exchanging, bread recipes. They're exchanging evidence, and evidence in this case. Yeah, Michael Brown could muddy up the waters. There's trouble with some of the DNA evidence, obviously, and the cell phone pinging location, the box, as they call it, the box around Penn Station and the box around Massapequa in that area. Okay, fine. That's one thing. But also, when you look at this, this is very, very different than that sort of stuff. This is people's memories. This is what people said to someone else, and they're repeating it. It's hearsay. Michael Brown can have a field day with Chief Harrison and Johnny Ray. I think he could really try to make a real, you know, jumbled mess out of everything that.
How about him calling Chief James Burke as a witness?
Right. Really, get James Burke up there and just grill the daylights out of him. He's got that right to do it because he can subpoena James Burke And James Burke is going to have to come in and testify and come up with some sort of ridiculous reason, whatever it is, why more resources weren't spent, why when they found this avalanche and whatever, all this other information, he could just roast him. And when you roast a person like that, you know, it could really throw a monkey wrench into the prosecutor's case. So he's going to have enough evidence to work with to really mess up the prosecution case. This is not a slam dunk case for the prosecution in any way, shape, or form. Michael Brown is good. He knows what he's doing. And there is enough evidence out there, information out there, especially involving Burke, to really muddy up the waters. And so I would not be surprised if Heuermann, if he is convicted, that he may not be convicted of all four. And I would not be surprised if there was a hung jury.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, a cynic. I'm a cop.
Every time we look at this case, I always refer to this 32-page bail application. And I'm inviting everyone that watches the show, has followed this case, to pull that up. You could still get it. It's still available. Yeah. Just put Rex Heuermann bail application, and then you print it, and you'll always have it. But it's the information that's in there is amazing. And the evidence that's in there is amazing. And when you realize that there's probably thousands and thousands more pages of the evidence that they have in this case, then you wonder what type of defense create doubt. We talk about, let's smear James Burke, Chief James Burke. That's the one thing that's everyone knows, that's where they're going. And then I played the Johnny Ray and what he presented. I don't believe any of that's believable, any of this stuff. And I'm not saying John Ray's not believable. The witnesses he brought forward to me are not believable. And so, but does that create doubt? Well, if Michael Brown, the attorney for Rex Heuermann, can bring forth those witnesses and create doubt with them, go ahead. But when you hear Michael Brown say, Rex Heuermann did not commit this crime. And then when you see some of the evidence, his computer searches, the burner phones, the DNA, and you're just like, all right, stop. All right. You know what I mean? Let's stop with that. No one's playing a violin and shedding tears for Rex Heuermann right now. And of course, everyone that goes to jail or prison finds the Lord, everyone finds the Lord, because they have so much, they have nothing but time on their hands. And, they're going to find the Lord. And Roseanne from the chat, can't Burke be held accountable for negligence on this case? Well, he already went to prison, Roseanne. So I don't think they could sue him for malfeasance now. He's off the job. I think he even got his pension, which is pretty amazing. I don't understand that. I guess you retire before you get convicted and you get your pension. And he was a four-star chief, so I'm sure he has a pretty sizable pension. One thing I didn't know, I was reading the documents, Burke was NYPD before he was Suffolk County.
For a short period of time, yeah.
Yeah, short period. I didn't know that. I saw that, oh my God, he's Paisan. He was former NYPD. Crazy. Aquarian One, was it his hair or his wife's hair? I heard his wife's hair was found. His wife's hair was found, but they also found DNA belonging to Rex Heuermann on one of the bodies also. Whether it was mitochondrial DNA via his hair. But H. Cook says two of hers and one of his. So, yes. So that's pretty damn strong evidence. We could have an eight-hour show and go over all the evidence in this, but I think people would fall asleep when you go over all that much evidence. But yet there's still a great deal of interest in this case. Mike, I think we gave a pretty good accounting of why and what they're going to do as far as a defense. And you see, there we go, Michael Brown, by all words, an excellent defense attorney. It's predictable that is the defense he's going to go with. And that's what I'm going to, that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Mike, your final thoughts.
Michael Brown's a great attorney. Rex Heuermann had excellent counsel, and Michael Brown, whatever he says, remember, he has a duty, an ethical obligation to zealously advocate for his client under the canon of ethics under New York state law. So therefore, he's going to do his job. He's going to do it well. This is not, again, this is not a slam dunk, because remember, there's four charges against Hurman. He may be convicted on one, two, maybe not all four. There may be a conviction on one and a hung jury on the others. You don't know. This may be very surprising. It's going to be a long, arduous trial, and Ray Tierney is going to be in the fight of his life. So there is no way to really predict how this is going to come out, but it's going to be a great trial.
Absolutely. Folks, I want to wish everyone a happy Memorial Day, as the actual day today, and give some thoughts for those who gave the ultimate sacrifice for our country. And thank you so much for tuning in today. Have a great rest of your night, and God bless everyone.
Good night. One episode.